scary.
There's that. Okay, our final principle that we're going to talk about is related creation. And essentially, this fifth principle is the glue to the whole thing. And it's the related creation, or if you want to retitle it a little bit, unity or unity in diversity, or you could say diversity and unity too, either way. And what we find here is essentially that God is the Trinity. And this is, it's amazing to me how, as I work with young people and Christians, how little they think about the Trinity, the center point of our understanding of God, and that's how confused we get about this. And so the thing that I like about going to Genesis is that you can see the Trinity in Genesis and in the creation of the world. We read in Genesis 1:1, of course, in the beginning God created. And we know here we refer to this, and we confess this both in the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed, that God the Father is the creator of the world. Okay? He created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth, and then it goes on to say, now the earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. We see the Spirit at work. And then it says, and God said, and we know that by His Word, the worlds were created. And we know that this Word is Christ Himself. John 1 tells us that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and He was with God in the beginning. So we see the whole, all three persons of the Godhead working and striving to create this marvelous work in creation. And this principle existed before creation, but is well demonstrated by creation. When we think about the Creator, again, I refer back to Jonathan Edwards, and please, I'm the worst when it comes to Jonathan Edwards' titles, because I never remember. I read them and I never remember them, but he's written on the Trinity as well, and it's well worth reading what he says on the Trinity too, because he's got some marvelous thoughts there. How the Father loves the Son and the Spirit so much that everything He does is for the Son and the Spirit. How the Spirit loves the Father and the Son so much that only everything He does is for the Father and the Son. That the Son loves the Father so much and the Spirit so much that everything He does is for the Father and the Spirit. And so in doing everything for everybody else, they build each other up and they just only get more glorious. It's just a marvelous concept of an understanding that the communication of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit to do everything in unity, together, the communication, the personalities of the, you know, three personalities working absolutely together. And this, again, bearing the image of God, this whole concept of personality, just a side note here, this is personal relationships. We talk about having a personal God, and this is rooted in our the concept of the Trinity, that because the Trinity is personal with each other and communicates and has koinonia within itself, that we too can have that same personality and that koinonia. And music is when most of us think, unfortunately, when most of us think about music today, we think in two ways. We think usually listening to some kind of electronic device listening to music, or we think of the concert stage. And these are modern ideas of what music is like, and these are probably the two most impersonal ways to deal with music. And the Bach would be shocked, honestly would be shocked at knowing that that's the way most people think about music. Because to him, music was the home, the coffee house, and the church. And we're going to look at that a little bit later, how that works out in as well. But to him, they were all his music making was relational. It was the koinonia of the congregation. It was the fellowship over Lutheran beverages down at the coffee house. And at home, around the table or around the harpsichord or whatever they were, all their instruments out, making music together as a family. So it's relational. Even when he was in the court, that's just a glorified home. And even the prince himself in the court played in his orchestras with him. So these are concepts that we need to understand. The Trinity works. When we understand the Trinity, we would begin to despise, in a sense, the just listening to music on a CD or just going to a concert. And here we got, excuse me, but we got God on the stage and we got the people in the audience. Think about this. Have you ever gone to a concert a really great concert, but you, how much relationship do you have with the person on stage? I've been to zillions of concerts, and I probably, talk to those people in the back very rarely. There's no relationship. You're just there, and so it's almost like a worship of the or worship the performer on stage, and that's the sad state of affairs. Not that you shouldn't go to concerts, by the way, but just think about what we've come to. I'd much rather have you make music in your home. We're much richer by making music in our homes and making music with each other in the church and with people in our workplace than we are in any other kind of music making. All right, well, back to the question before the composer then, in as we look at the Trinity, is whether the... think about in the personality of God, you have three persons, but one God. And this is crucial in our understanding of, and this has been, by the way, the great philosophical question of history, hasn't it? One of the great ideas, if you study the great ideas, but probably the one great idea that ties all other ideas together. And it's the major controversy in philosophy is what? Platonic thinking against Aristotelian thinking. Those that have studied Francis Schaeffer will recognize this from How Should We Then Live, too, right? That in Plato, you have Plato holding up the universe as being the key to understanding all things, to understanding of our life, to understanding why we're here. And Aristotle says, no, the key is in the particulars, the diversity of nature and creation. And the question becomes, which one is right? And but the answer is that both are equally ultimate. Both are equally ultimate. So we cannot live without universality, nor can we live without diversity. There's a John Rushdoony said this in his book The One and the Many. All factuality in the universe is created or understandable only in terms of the ontological Trinity, that is, the Trinity in a relationship to itself or in terms of its own being. Because he created it, its meaning is also created meaning, derived from him who made it. Now think about that, that all meaning is derived from the Trinity. There's no meaning that's not derived, no true meaning that's not derived from the Trinity. And that's crucial to how we understand life. Meaning then is derived from the triune God. Man is a creature created in God's image, and meaning in anything that man makes is also derived from the triune God. So that everything we do artistically has derived meaning. Now it's either the truth of God or it's rebellion against God. There's no neutral ground here, see. It's like sanctification. You're either being sanctified, and by the way, sanctification is parallel with this. It's all part of this. Or you're sinning. You can't be neutral about this whole thing. And we're always moving one direction or the other. We're all either approaching the city or we're backing off. And that, when we understand that, it sort of gives a whole new dimension to how we deal with our own lives, how we think about how our lives are. so a composer, also understanding that all meaning is derived from the Trinity, he must compose his works within biblical boundaries. He must, and that's what these principles are all about. I hope you realize, see that they're broad principles. They're not narrowing. They're not saying that you can't do this or you can't do that. It's saying that this is the way God created the earth and the world, and as imitators, we should create like him. We must not allow then the unity of music to be all-encompassing at the expense of its diversity. A composer who slavishly follows textbook form without inspiration is one of these kind of guys, and the fault generally leads to boredom in music. It's likewise the one who, without unifying the elements in music, the music becomes unintelligible. All right, so. Think there's a movie, I guess it's almost 20 years ago now, called Amadeus. Anybody see Amadeus? Okay, good. I'm getting to the point where I used to be able to use this a lot because everybody had seen it, but nowadays, especially with young people, they haven't seen this movie, which is probably a good thing. But the movie essentially takes, and by the way, the historical facts of the movie are totally off, and it's truly historical fiction. I mean, actually, it's just fiction, but yes.
We actually had one scene in one of our Sunday school classes.
Really? Okay, good. But Mozart and Salieri are two composers who truly did exist, and Salieri today is, the only reason anybody knows Salieri is because of the movie Amadeus. Otherwise, people would probably not have heard too much of him. And there's good reason for him, and I if you read the biography, of Salieri, the American biography of him. The biographer himself says that his music was, he doesn't use these words, but he might as well, was slavishly following the textbook forms of the day. And his music literally is boring. I mean, it's, and he was the great, he was of the, at the time, the higher paid professional. Mozart had a hard time in life. But Mozart, what made Mozart's music more interesting than Salieri's? Well, the concept, the unity of, think about symmetry. Perfect symmetry can be boring. Or I should say, absolute symmetry can be boring. All right? So if you have something, if you arrange your mantle with everything perfectly balanced on one side and the exact same thing on one side and the other, and so if you actually folded it together, it'd be the same thing. Sorry, I hope I'm not getting. I found this out because it's happened to us. We were doing this, and some of you know Denise Greenway. She came in and fixed. She's an artist, and she said, "Oh, you don't want that." And she moves a few things around, you know, same stuff on the mantle, and all of a sudden it looks good. And it's balanced, but it's not absolute symmetry anymore. And all of a sudden, why does that look good? And ours didn't, you know, because ours was boring after a while. And a house that's perfectly exact, you know, like the White House or the Capitol building. And these are all built on classical models where man was attempting absolute symmetry as perfection. The classical musical period was one of these periods. Salieri was a classical musician.
I'm sorry, the criticism that you cited, that was Mozart of Salieri or the other way?
No, just as we observed them, that why is Salieri sort of a dud composer,
okay,
and Mozart a good composer? Well, Mozart, we're going to listen to a little Mozart. Okay, what you expect in perfect sonata allegro form of the classical period is four measures, four measures, four measures, four measures. That's your theme. Then you expect four measures, four measures, four measures, four measures. This is what Haydn does. And even Haydn doesn't do this always slavishly either, and that's why he's a good composer. But some do. But let's listen to Mozart just a little bit here. And okay. We'll try this again. Uh-oh. There we go. You know, it's quiet, so you can't have to. Oh, no, I'm. No, I have the wrong one. I think I need to go five. Yeah. There we go. Let's try that. Technical.
Where's Kim when you need her?
I know.
It changes a bit.
Is that? Oh, there. I had it on 7, didn't I? See, up from here, it looked like 1. All right.
Here you go.
I want one.
One or seven?
One, yeah.
Right.
It's a good skit.
The problem is not in your CD player.
Oh, there we go.
There's the bell. Time for the minute waltz.
Okay, after, can I repeat that? Let's see if I can do this right. Okay, we're going to have it quiet because you have to. It's so quiet at the beginning, you'll not catch this if you don't. If you, right, we'll try. There we go. Why did he do that? All right. See, your expectation was what? 4-4-4-4. And what do you do? And he keeps going. And what does that do? It's like a joke. See, what's a joke? A joke is expectations dashed. And that makes us laugh. That makes us delighted. That's Trinitarian. See, the Trinity is the expectation, and then the expectation changed so that it delights the personality. And this is the unity and diversity. So the textbook form is boring. If you always got what you expected, after a while you just go to sleep. Now you can take the opposite, which is complete diversity, and I can do this in about 5 seconds, hopefully. And this is diversity at its ultimate. Now there's something you go whistling home, won't you? And that's, that's one of my favorite tunes. I sing it all the time. There's where diversity actually comes into play so great that it's unmemorable, completely unmemorable. The mind can't even grasp it. There's yes. It is.
It's systematized diversity.
Well, I wanted to play the P. Rollinaire, which actually is not unified, yeah. Which would be a better example, but I had this one out. So, exactly. And
seriously, what do you mean? What does that mean to the layman when you say it's excessively unified?
Well, let me go, because this goes into one of our concepts. Remember, we said that what we want to do is look at creation and create as God, imitators of God. What Schoenberg does, so he sets up, when we look at creation, we see the logical systems. In creation, we find this scale, or these notes, and it doesn't matter which order you play them in. We just happen to put them in this order. And there's a reason for that we put them in that order. They're based on a harmonic system. In other words, in this note, there's this note, this note, this note, this note, this note, etc. But if you build a scale from that first partial, you come up eventually with a diatonic scale. That's the white note scale. And if you keep on going, you come up with the black notes on top of it. All right. The white note scale, then, or the diatonic scale, is something that is observed in creation. It is what we build most of what we like in music. All right. Schoenberg, what he does, he works with this diatonic and the chromatic scale, but he says, I'm no longer going to do it by, well, you got, see, remember when we did that half step like this? That naturally leads in that note, and by the way, there's a hierarchy of leading in each of the notes. We also, that note leads into that note, and it's part of two scales. It's part of this scale. It's also part of this scale. Now we're getting into technicalities, okay? But each note has a leading one way, or has a strength moving to one note or another. And a composer understands this and works. That relationship is very strong in composition, and a composer works with that very much. Notice on our... so that there it is. Schütz begins with that interval because he knows the strength of that interval, and he uses that. Well, Schoenberg says, well, I'm going to do something. I'm going to take all 13 of these notes, and he devises a completely logical system. And he says, well, I'm going to play this note. I might play it in this order. And he may say, well, that's the order, and I'm going to keep that order. But I'll tell you what, for diversity, let's do this. I can play it backwards. I can play it upside down, and I can play it upside down and backwards. Those are the four permutations that I have, or the three permutations of the... And so he calls this the dodecaphonic system, or 12-tone system. A serial technique, the series. He develops a series of these notes over and over and over and over again. And you can't play the first note until you've played the other 12. And it's very completely logical, completely ugly. All right. And there's no way you can put together a full 12-tone. He came pretty close sometimes, by the way. He understood harmony when he tried to develop them so that they fit our harmonic scheme that we know. Of the common practice period or the 19th century, then he came pretty close to making some nice music sometimes, but he couldn't ever quite perfect it because it's impossible with the notes, given notes. But he serialized it. Now, a series of notes, and then he also serialized the pitch, the harmonies, and the he could serialize the timbres. He could serialize the volume. He could serialize the a variety of different rhythmic aspects. Now, the problem with a series is what?
Is that the unity you're talking about, the serialization?
Right.
That's the sense in which he unified.
Right. What's the problem with a series? Where do we see absolute series in creation? Maybe you can help me out there. Do you know of any absolute series in creation? But Fibonacci sequence is not... It's not a symmetrical series, exactly.
Time?
Is time? Can't you stretch time by going faster?
No, you move greater distance than the same amount of time.
I don't know. I mean, again, I'm not a... Yeah. See, creation's sort of strange this way, isn't it? It's not... Peanut minds, we want to...
Well, this is a joke and we should be delighted.
That's exactly right. Well, Schoenberg's a joke and we shouldn't be delighted. All right, because what he's done is, he can't escape totally being made in God's image. We have to understand that. But what he does do is he's in rebellion. He's trying to move away from creation. And he's trying to create his own alternate reality. And it's impossible. That's the whole point. And what it does is it brings ugliness into the world. All right. That's just ugly, really. I sat through all of Pierrot Lunaire once in Vienna, and it was one of the longest nights ever. I kind of thought what hell might be like. When, let's get back a little bit to the, I hope that helps a little bit to understand. Man is, think about unity and diversity. Think about God. When God created the world, when God creates, it looks like God, doesn't it?
By unity, you mean there's a definable structure.
Right. Well, there's one, one God. Everything, the whole personality, the three personalities of God are not separate in a sense. Because Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. But is Jesus the Father? We confess no, right? All right? And that's the whole point. I'm not going to try and explain that. That's the truth. And do we see this unity and diversity in creation? Think of a tree. What tree are you thinking of? Are you thinking of maple? Oak? Pine? Sycamore, a tree, all right? See, how many different kinds of trees are there? Thousands of kinds of trees. Let's just take a maple, for instance. A maple tree, how many different kinds of maples are there? Lots. At least a dozen that I know of, and there's probably more than that. And if you take a maple, let's take the sugar maple, for instance, the Canada flag, you can all relate to that, right? If you take the Canada flag and fold it on top of each other, halfway, that take that leaf and fold it, they fold right on top of each other. They're absolutely symmetrical. Are there any maple leaves that do that? No, not likely. We haven't found one yet, right? Okay. We haven't found one yet. Now, if we take...
And it was billions of dollars in research.
Now, that's a good way to get government money. Maybe you should try. And it keep you busy for the rest of your life. Then the other thing is, if we take all the maple leaves off of one maple tree and put them on top of each other, will you find any two alike?
Nope.
But they're all from the same maple tree. Are you beginning to get the concept of how God...
Sugar
maple leaves, exactly. Exactly.
There's unity and diversity.
Precisely. And there was the Magic House in St. Louis. You go in and you can look at your face in a mirror. They probably have in other places here, where you see, put two sides of your face together, and that, you talk about funny. people's mouths, one goes up, one goes down, and when you put them both, you really look funny if you were absolutely symmetrical on one side or the other. So this is a picture of how God creates. And think about this. This is one of my arguments for creation, or for understanding that there's a triune God from creation, not that we need... In order for salvation, of course, we need the scriptures. But God says in Romans 1 that everyone knows who God is by looking at creation. And think about this. Imagine Bach was the only composer. Would we say that this music is by Bach? What would we probably say? Oh, this is just music, isn't it? And see, this is the problem. When God creates, we don't think, oh, this is God's creation because it looks like him. We say, oh, this is creation. If there were, impossible here, but if there were different gods creating, each god would create as his personality would be, wouldn't it? All right. So let's say Allah did create the world. What would it look like? What would people look like? Think about this. What would people look like? Would we be... you don't want me creating it. But if Allah had created the world, what would we look like as people? Only one God,
all
one person.
Same.
All the same.
All
exactly. That would be the nature of his being, wouldn't it? All right.
Your point is that element of reality, there's not reflected.
That's right. And pantheism, what would we look, if let's say the Greek gods were the real gods and they created us, what would we look like? Well, first of all, you probably couldn't tell that we were people. We'd all be different kinds of creatures. See, the particularities would be so diverse that we wouldn't... God has made us, we look at each other, we can see we're all people, but every one of us is distinct from each other, aren't we? That's really Trinitarian, That's about, and there's no confusing who we are. And yet we all have the same features. We can see that we're all people. It's just an incredible thing. well, anyway, I don't want to get onto this, but this is God's intention in music is to be this way as well. The delightful music is that which is unified and diverse. And I take 2 minutes just to take, or let's just take the hymn, "Be Thou My Vision." Can you all pretty much sing that together? I want you to just think about this. Think about the five principles that we've talked about. Think about the linear aspect of this melodic line. It's a very simple tune that really embodies many of these principles very well. Think about how it grows to the inevitability of the end. Think about its formal structure of four phrases and how they work together. And think about the tension that's created all the way to the third phrase and then rests on the fourth phrase. And think of the unity of sound, the unity of rhythmic aspects, and then the diversity of melodic aspects, and how it becomes, in essence, a great tune. Let's just sing it together. Be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. Not be all else to me, save that thou art. Now my best art, by day or by night, waking or sleeping, thy presence my light. There's the Sabbath principle in the four. And if you take it, bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, 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 you got little ones in there as well, all the way down to the micro unit. Okay, there's that aspect. Notice that we can't just stop at the third phrase, could we? What if it would happen? It's inevitable that we have to go all the way to the end, isn't it? There's a line, there's the bum, bum, ba-da-dum, bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. Cause and effect. Notice the two lines are very similar shape, aren't they? So one gets its information from the previous shape of the line and then adds to that shape cyclical ideas. It's patterns growing. Bum, ba da 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 dum, bum, 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 bum. And then we reach our climax. Bum, 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 ba da dum, ba da dum, bum, bum, bum. And come to a point of rest. This is a picture of what a good tune can do. Very simple. See, we're not talking about necessarily complex artworks. Although complex artwork can come into play, all artworks, doesn't matter, simple or complex, work in this understanding.
And you're saying we see that pattern then in creation.
Right. There's a reason for this to be in the church. Why this hymn is so loved by everybody. And works and has worked and will work for ever.
If you go back to the scales, you would see that. Is that the same place you see that scale? That's why you say that.
That's right.
The scale that we use typically is
right.
It's a creation pattern in the scale that takes favor to compose. Didn't fit that same pattern.
Right.
So are there other scales that are used in the world besides just the one that we use?
Yes. The minor scales, I think, actually reflect, and you'll find that the great musicians will use more minor scales than they do major scales. I think, wouldn't you agree that it's probably a higher percentage of great minor works than there are major works? The minor actually shows more, in my mind, the schematic structure of the scale is much more... allows for more unity and diversity than the major scale does.
But, I mean, I'm not talking about...
Well, you're talking about like microtonal scales and things like that.
I'm just talking about, are there other...
Yes.
We're talking about Western music, and I'm talking about, are there other musics throughout the world that don't
yes.
even recognize our type of...
Well, they all recognize ours, but they all have their own
right.
as well, like the microtonal systems of India and other places you have.
Part of it, they're completely different scales in the world that have nothing to do with ours, and that's the way it
No.
If you listen to Aboriginal music, if you listen to Indian music or Balinese music or whatever, the more music I listen to, the more I realize the prominence of the perfect fifth. That every
yes.
culture uses the perfect fifth, like you were playing, like Schuster. Every culture uses it.
Or the minor third. The minor third is another place.
Which we use in our speech. And
yes.
It seems to be the more I listen to
Johnny.
Different parts of the world, is that all the microtonal stuff is really a coloration.
Yes, you'll find that the most prominent folk scale is the pentatonic scale, which was not a complete, which is a is an incomplete diatonic scale. All right, it's chromaticism is something that is development. It's not something that you just normally do. Yes.
The gifted artists and composers.
That's right.
The people, the ordinary person writing music to sing for himself,
mm-hmm.
that's the common scale.
Mm-hmm.
See, I didn't, when you drew that picture, it showed me something that maybe, if you were an artist, you visualize that as a classical, a Greek classical, the golden, the golden world, or something like that.
Yeah.
Can you draw a rectangle that divides up into thirds, or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if you're going
to... Well, I know what you... Yeah.
Uh-huh. And people all over the world probably recognize that.
Because we're made in the image of God.
Huh?
We can discover that via creation as image bearers.
Okay.
Now, again, the Bible... And this is the whole point of all this. We take these four principles, these five principles that we... let's take the five elements of music: pitch, rhythm, timbre, harmony, and form. And if those are our elements, that's what we discover in creation. Right? That's there for everybody to do in creation. And as we manipulate those in creation, we're free to do as we want. But when we bring these alongside, I say this is where I'm coming from. Okay, now we see how God uses creation principles, which are beyond music. They're architectural, they're artistic, they're dance, they're drama. And we take these principles and we line them together. And when the paradigms of the two are lined properly, not like this, but like this, then we begin to realize, oh, we're creating as God wants us to create. Does that make sense? This is a hard part. But if we get there, then we have some place to move together as a body of believers, saying, okay, why does this work and why does this not work? So rather than argue about this style and that style, we need to work with principles, just like the Ten Commandments are principles. You know, we understand all of, I mean, we have a whole law system in the West built on essentially the Ten Commandments when we were Christian roots. So, and the same thing can happen then this way as well. Well, I'm going to put this. I got 5 minutes. I'm going to take. I do need to cover this. I'm going to do this as quickly as possible. Can I take 10?
Yeah. I mean, we don't actually eat till 12:30.
Okay. This is supposedly the icing on the cake.
Okay.
When we take these principles, we need to understand how creation. Then see Genesis 3 is the culmination of all this. And we begin to see in the fall, first of all, we see the kingdom model in Eden. And I'm going to do this very quickly, but it says in the Bible, and I'm going to read so much from the Bible, I'm just going to do it quickly here. But it says that God took man and formed him in Eden. He was placed in Eden, in the garden, east in Eden. So if we have Eden here, I don't know what it looked like, but we'll just make it that way, boxy right now. And east in Eden, there was a garden. All right. Yeah, the golden rectangle. And we find that in the garden, Adam was placed here in the garden in order to dress and keep it. The words dress and keep are really fascinating words. The word to dress is the word... the Hebrew word, but it goes into the Septuagint rather interestingly as letreo, Laetreo, which is our word, the verb form of liturgy or service. Liturgy in the Greek sense was service to the state. You are a slave to the state. Okay. And in the word, in Paul uses liturgy as service to the Lord. When we have a worship service, we have a worship liturgy, literally. All right. And our service is to God, and actually it's interesting that there's liturgical service to us as well from God. It works both ways. And but this is all designed from the garden. This is the place. The garden was the place of worship. So we have Eden, and we have the garden. And Adam was placed here, and there were two trees: the tree of knowledge and tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the tree of life. And Adam was told not to eat of the tree of the tree of knowledge of evil, good and evil. In the keeping aspect is also important. To keep it is to guard it. The same word is used later on when the cherubim guard the garden when Adam and Eve are thrown out. It's the exact same word. So to keep it is to guard it. And Adam was so we have, we begin to see here, then there was a river that flowed out of Eden. I'll use purple since I already got blue in there. And when it got into the garden, it broke off into four headwaters. And there the Gihon, the Pishon, the Tigris, and the Euphrates. And one of them, there's all this bdellium and onyx and gold at the end of it. And it goes into the land of Havilah, which is Arabia. And the gold there is good, it said. And we see bdellium and gold and onyx are essentially, you've got precious metals and precious stones. And the precious stones are black and white. Bdellium is white and onyx is black. So it covers the spectrum of the rainbow, well, of the colors. They're non-colors, but they cover the spectrum. But what we have here, now notice rivers. When we think of rivers, we think of, you have ever heard of rivers of civilization? You know, people always use rivers to show the flow of civilization, because rivers always move civilization, don't they? Throughout all history, rivers have moved civilization somewhere. We went out west because of the rivers, didn't we? And we used the rivers. I come from Kansas City, and Lewis and Clark, you know, we know all about rivers and moving culture. Well, notice this is, the rivers are flowing out, so we know which direction they're going. They're going downhill, aren't they, this way. And Adam was placed in the garden, and the naturally, how did he know there was gold, bdellium, and onyx? Well, God told him. Well, why did God tell him? Well, he had to dress and keep the garden, didn't he? So what's he going to do? He's going to go out into the world and get these raw materials so he can dress and keep the garden. Dress it up. Cultivate. So he's moved out, the rivers move him out, and he brings back the raw materials. Now, we understand, this is, God meets with Adam in the sanctuary, doesn't he? That's where Adam was when he was in trouble. All right? And God was walking there with looking for him, and Adam was hiding. But this is where they were to meet, and God was going to teach him how to dress and keep the garden. He was going to instruct him. But Adam rebelled. But anyway, the point is, this is where we meet with God. This is where God lives. Eden was Adam's home. This is where he was supposed to live. And he was supposed to find out how God was going to make his home. And then he would make his home, he would, as a servant, because he's serving, he's the servant of the garden. Well, if you know you got a good master, and you like the way he makes his home, what are you going to do? Ephesians 5, again, imitate God. So what are you going to do? You're going to imitate God. You're going to make your home like his. Think about the tabernacle. What do we got in the tabernacle? You got the throne room, which is what? God's living room. You got the table of, you got the holy place, which is where the table of showbread and the lampstand and the altar of incense are. That's his dining room, right? And you got the altar outside of the tent, which is his kitchen. That's where you cook his sacrifice, right? All right, this is home. Judgment goes on, and you know, in the Holy of Holies, and other things go on. So We design our homes a lot like that, don't we? We have places of, we gather the family in the living room for the, where the father is the judge of the family. And we eat around the table and we cook in the kitchen. And this is the way our lives work. But and the other thing we see here is now with sanctuary, home, and then the world. And if you think back to Bach, church, home, tavern, something like, or workplace, you know, the coffee house, where he meets other people, the work, people outside. And so we begin to see that the point of all this is that we see raw materials in the world are brought into the sanctuary. God teaches us how to make things, how to make his, dress his sanctuary. We dress our home that way. And as we deal with people in the outside world, they see our homes and they make their homes like our homes. So the pagan is influenced by the Christian. That's the way it's supposed to be. Unfortunately, today, we do the opposite. What do? We don't go out and get the raw materials. What do? We go out and get the finished product from the pagan and bring it back into the sanctuary. And we baptize it. You know, got Jesus? You know what I mean? See, this is... We can't come up with, we don't listen to Jesus on how to make the world. We listen to what the world says, and we think that we can bring them in that way. That's not the way God tells us to do it. He says, you listen to me. You know, you got raw materials in the world. I'll show you how to fashion them. And how do we do that? We do that in our worship. This is why worship is so important. This is God speaking to us. And we need to listen to him and not to the world. Because we're supposed to transform the world. We can't be salt in the world if the world is the salt already. So we need to make the salt so that we can salt them and not have them salt us. So that's the pattern that we see in Genesis. And that was a quick version of that. Sorry about that. And one other thing, I'd like to look at the fall, because this is crucial. In the fall, we see that Adam was... Where was Adam when Eve was approached by the serpent? What does it say in the Bible? Have you ever noticed that? He was with her. That's what it says. And Adam, who was with her... Now, think about this. What is the first command that God gave Adam? First command is 1:26 and 27, which is take dominion. Okay. What's the second command that he gives him? It's not the eating, not eating. It's the actually to dress and keep the garden. And then it's the tree. All right. So remember, what did keep mean? Remember, it's guard the garden. So what was Adam to guard the garden from? I didn't know there was something he needed to guard. Well, there was, because I'm, and again, this is a me, and you can take it for as it's worth. I think that the fall happened on the first Sabbath. I think that it happened on the first Sabbath. And that it happened actually perhaps even the sixth day before the first Sabbath. And the cool of the day, which would be the evening or the early of the first Sabbath. And here Adam and Eve are in the garden, and the serpent enters. He's already fallen from heaven. We can read about that in other parts of the Bible. A little cryptic, but it's there. And what should have happened? Adam should have been the keeper, shouldn't he? He'd been the guard. He should have said, Satan, what are you talking to my wife for? Who's in charge here? But instead, like a typical male, sorry guys, he says, well, let's see what happens. Let's see what, you know, I just kind of let it play out here, and we'll see what happens to her if she eats, you know. And he's sitting there, and she eats, nothing happens, and he eats. Then, of course, God comes. And all of a sudden, it's like the little boy with a cookie hand in the cookie jar is caught by mom with his hand in the cookie jar. And he blames the woman. And so we get this in the fall, because Adam didn't do his job of guarding. Eventually, God has to put cherubim in front of the garden to keep him from there, to keep him out. Somebody has to guard the garden. That's so crucial. If you don't understand that, that somebody has to guard the sanctuary, then we don't understand what it means to be a Christian, because we're all in the priesthood of believers. I'm going to get to that in just a second. Now, the Adam takes, well, the curse comes on Adam and Eve. Adam is cursed to work by the sweat of his brow. Woman is cursed with the desire for her husband. And the desire, interestingly, the idea that she wants to rule over her husband, and of course, men being lazy, they'll allow that. And men are, because they're supposed to work, that's why they're lazy, because they're supposed to work. So our curse works against us in our fallen nature, doesn't it? When I teach, you know, it's amazing when I teach, especially, it's so transparent in elementary kids. Invariably in my teaching classes, the little girls will want to try and tell me what to do in my class. Invariably, the little boys won't want to do anything in my class. All right. That's the sin that God has, you know, that's the curse working in our lives. Well, now with that, we understand that the curse has caused this problem, but then God, in his infinite mercy, comes and develops a system for his people, and that is in the priesthood. In the Old Testament, it's this priesthood of Israel. Israel was a kingdom of priests, and we see that the priests had various duties to do. Eventually, the Levitical priesthood took over these duties, and these duties include prayer. We can read about, I won't give you all the, but Exodus 27 talks about this, Exodus 30. Other priestly duties, offering of sacrifices, Leviticus 1, 1 through 17. Blessing of the people, Numbers 6, 23 through 27. The teaching of the law, Leviticus 10. All these are priestly duties. But my favorite priestly duty, well, favorite for this purpose, is found in Numbers. I'm going to read this to you, Numbers 3:38, if you want to look at it with me. This is one that we forget, unfortunately. In 3:38, it says, "Now those who are to camp before the tabernacle eastward, before the tent of meeting, toward the sunrise, are Moses and Aaron and his sons, performing the duties of the sanctuary." So we see the priests are performing the duties of the sanctuary for the obligation of the sons of Israel. But the layman coming near was to be put to death. The priest had a duty to guard the sanctuary. Now, what is that? How does that translate into the New Testament? And very quickly, and I think you can all go with me here, our priestly duties are defined by Peter in 1 Peter when he says that we are a nation and kingdom of priests. We are a royal priesthood, a holy nation, set apart to do his work. Okay, I wish we had more time to develop this up. Luther's done this so marvelously. Read Martin Luther on the priesthood of believers. It's some of the best stuff. So we have a vocation. Our priestly calling is our vocation. We all have a special vocation, and we all have a general vocation. Our special vocation is what most of us do on our daily lives. Some of it may be a homemaker. Some of it may be a lawyer. Someone may be a physicist. Someone may be a preacher. Someone may be a musician. Those are our special callings. And we are called as priests to guard the sanctuary in our calling. So if you're a lawyer, you make sure that the law that follows, that you keep the law in a proper way. All right. If you're then as a musician, I have, for instance, and those that work in the church have a calling to guard the sanctuary of the music that goes in, so that what goes into the sanctuary is pleasing to God. That's a tough calling, because most people don't want us to do that. Okay. And most musicians will capitulate on this area and say, "Oh, well, I want to make everybody, I'd rather make people happy than God happy." And they know that sometimes. I know, I deal with these guys a lot. So that's a special vocation. General vocation. You have a general vocation as a Christian to guard the sanctuary. We all do. We all need to be prayer warriors, right? We all need to be ready to give the gospel, teach the gospel, disciple nations. That's one of our duties as priests. right? We all need to attend worship and bring the sacrifices, the living sacrifices, to Christ. See, these are, and what was I? Forgot my, the blessing of the people. We need to bless each other in our koinonia, in our fellowship with each other in the church. We all need to guard the sanctuary. And in music, by the way, this is how, this is going to be my suggestion. We can, this is where you can argue with me if you want. But this is where, this is my suggestion. As a priestly duties, what duties do you have? Because God, and we'll deal with this a little bit in the sermon, God calls us to sing to Him. And in that singing, that we have an obligation to sing skillfully too. Believe it or not, that's what Psalm 33 says. That means as priests, we have the responsibility of being able to sing music and read music. Now, I know this is a hard burden for all the old guys that haven't learned how to read music. But we're only ever one generation from having a church that can read music. Why would we want to be able to read music? Well, it's fun. You know, I'd never sung the one we just sang. But I was able to sing along because I could read music. Imagine going to a church, you're visiting now somewhere, and you go to a church and you pull out the hymnal and I never sang this hymn, but oh, I can sing this. See, but then also there's more than just that too. The participation though in worship, we are people of the book. By the way, it's so good to have hymnals. By the way, that's a Christian concept. I'm not against things on the walls, but we're people of the book, and the problem is when it goes on the wall, it often doesn't have music on it. For me to go into or for somebody that can read music, you go into a worship service and all there are words, you can't participate because you don't know the tune. And that's not good. As soon as you put the tune in there, no matter what style, you can sing it. We have an obligation there as the priesthood, I think, to teach our children how to read music so that they can play skillfully before the Lord. And we'll deal with that a lot more in the sermon. So, close that off quickly, but that's where I wanted to go with that. So I'm sure that ought to get a few more questions and things stirred up.